And welcome to the reading of the Courier for Tuesday, May 18th, 2021. We've got a cloudy, rainy Tuesday ahead, so a good day to be inside and reading. Our headline for the Courier's front page today, Waterloo replaces Griffin logo, Northeast Iowa hospitals ranked by feds, brews, bikes, and hikes, Cedar Falls Council drops mask mandate. We'll start with our lead article, Waterloo replaces Griffin logo. City Council votes 5-2 to scrape what some feel is racist, by journalist Sydney Crizon. Waterloo, a long-standing red Griffin logo, criticized for resembling a Ku Klux Klan dragon, is no longer the Waterloo Police Department's insignia. The City Council voted 5-2 to replace the existing logo Monday. The new insignia is a solid yellow patch with red lettering stating Waterloo Police. It includes the term vigilance and the year 1868, when the police department was established. The Waterloo Police Protective Association first suggested the design in late April. Council members Margaret Klein and Dave Boyson voted against adopting the new logo. The vote came after pushback from more than a dozen residents, many of whom cited tradition and pride or urged the City Council to focus its efforts on issues they felt were more pressing. Several activists condemned the Red Griffin as having racist ties, citing personal encounters with police violence. Blackhawk County NAACP President Latanya Graves, who served on the logo rebranding committee, said her 11-year-old self saw her aunt beaten by Waterloo police for picking apples from a tree. "Every time we have this conversation, it reminds me of what I witnessed," Graves said. "You just don't understand. You just truly don't understand." Human Rights Commissioner Teresa Culpepper, who also served on the rebranding committee, said Waterloo is making great strides, but cannot forget its history of applying the law unfairly to some residents. "I'm tired of explaining black pain," Culpepper said. "I am tired." Another woman, who only gave her name as Joy, said she was tired of being a police wife, having to defend officers. She said the Griffin is on her late husband's urn. She called the logo change ridiculous and criticized City Council members for not listening to constituents. "It's crazy. I don't get why you people are so adamant about getting rid of the Griffin that people treasure so much," said another woman, who shared her name as Becky. "And you can't say, oh, it's that patch on the shoulder that's causing problems. Oh, that's evil patch. No, it's people's attitudes." Joyce Livingston, a local Black Lives Matter organizer, objected to the term "you people" being used to describe the city's black population. She said Griffin supporters spoke largely without regard for the trauma experienced by their black neighbors at the hands of police. "I think it's pretty obvious who's for and who's against the Griffin," Livingston said, referencing the racial divide. She criticized several people's call for a citywide vote on the Griffin replacement. She said that suggestion is meant to silence Waterloo's black community, which makes up 16.7% of the city's population, according to the U.S. Census data. Activist Nana Wilder said the Griffin was previously called a derogatory name that included the N-word. She said issues that affect some people in the community, like the Griffin logo, affect everyone in the community. "If the majority of individuals that had a problem with the Griffin were white, we wouldn't even be having this issue," Wilder said. Lynn Moeller, retired officer and chair of a new pro-police PAC, said a silent majority of residents supports the Griffin. He said officers don't intend to hurt or kill people on the job and urged people to comply with police, which he said is a simple damn word to remember. "The skin you have doesn't mean a damn thing," Mueller said. "I got a lot of friends who are black. You've heard that 10 million times. It ain't your skin color, it's your attitude, behavior, and conduct that will get your butt thrown in jail." Klein initially tried to table a discussion until after the November election, in which the mayor and four council seats are on the ballot. She and Boyson were the only votes supporting her motion. The councilwoman said she felt the rebranding committee was a sham, and anyone who spoke against replacing the Griffin was labeled a racist. She said it was a low blow that Mayor Quentin Hart did not approach the police department about the logo before the city council formed a rebranding committee. Councilman Jonathan Greider said delaying controversial decisions would take away the governing body's responsibility. This is masquerading as democracy when what it really is taking away the voices of the people that voted us to be here, Greider said. By that logic, we will do nothing here. Hart and others disputed claims they are anti-police. Several elected officials pointed to their support for funding the new police equipment, training, and other needs. Hart said the local government's partnership with the police department significantly lessened misconduct lawsuits. This process has really been enlightening for a few different reasons, and I can only imagine if the mayor had actually cast a vote that day, what people would do to me, the threats, the overtones, Hart said about the August decision to form the rebranding committee. Michelle Widener, the city's chief financial officer, said the city will use interest earned on bond funds to pay for Griffin replacement. Monday's resolution was amended by Councilwoman Sharon Wan to include uniforms, vehicle graphics, letterheads, and department objects, except weapons. It gave Hart authority to make a schedule for logo replacement on weapons. The police department estimates Griffin replacement will cost more than $152,000, city documents show. Our next article on the front page of the Tuesday Courier, Northeast Iowa hospitals ranked by feds. Mercy One, Cedar Falls, receives 5-star rating by journalist Amy Rivers. Some hospitals in Northeast Iowa fared better than others when it comes to the annual quality ratings released by the federal government. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, or CMS, released the star ratings late last month, taking into account mortality, safety of care, readmission, patient experience, and timely effective care into their measurement. Mercy One Cedar Falls Medical Center, formerly Saratori Hospital, was the only acute care hospital in the Cedar Valley to receive a 5-star rating. The top rating a hospital could receive. It was one of 12 in the state of Iowa receiving the highest rating. The company saw 3 of its locations, including the Dubuque and Iowa City, among just 455 hospitals in the United States receiving a 5-star rating. These 5-star ratings from the CMS reinforce the quality of care and patient experience we are honored to provide, CEO Bob Wrights said in a press release touting the ratings. Unity Point Waterloo, also an acute care hospital, got a 4-star rating, as did Critical Access Hospitals, Floyd County Medical Center in Charles City, and Mitchell County Regional Healthcare in Osage. Those receiving 3-star ratings were Acute Care Hospital Mercy One Waterloo, Medical Center and Critical Access Hospitals, Waverly Health Center, and Mercy One North Iowa Medical Center in Mason City. More than 1,000 hospitals across the country received 3 stars. On the lower end of the spectrum, Unity Point Health Marshalltown and Winneshiek Medical Center in Decorah were rated 2 stars out of 5. No hospital in Iowa had a 1-star rating. A plurality, 1,181 of hospitals across the country were not rated at all. That included many smaller, critical access hospitals, including Community Memorial in Sumner, Buchanan County Health Center in Independence, Mercy Medical Center in New Hampton, Mercy One Owine Medical Center, Gunderson Palmer Lutheran in West Union, and Grundy County Memorial and Grundy Center. Hospital administrators noted several reasons for lower scores. We look for opportunities for improvement wherever we can, whether we are a 5-star or a 3-star medical center, said Mercy One Northeast Iowa Chief Medical Officer Dr. Matthew Sojak. Going through the pandemic, we found that due to high volumes and high acuity, we had to adjust to ensure patients received the best possible care. Waverly Health Center was focusing on emergency room discharge times, support for breastfeeding mothers, and reducing induction of early labor, said Chief Operating Officer Heidi Solheim. Continuous quality improvement and process refinement is essential for every healthcare provider to ensure we provide the best possible care for our patients, Solheim said. UnityPoint said the CMS rating is one of a number of ratings provided by outside organizations that sometimes create confusion for customers because of the varying metrics. We recognize that quality improvement is an ongoing proposition and have actively engaged in a number of continuous improvement initiatives, the statement said, like daily safety huddles, bedside handoff reporting, hourly rounding, and others. Our next article on the Tuesday's front page of the Courier, Brews, Bikes, and Hikes is the headline. Cedar Valley Beer Trail launches Saturday. The article is accompanied by a large, colorful picture. The caption reads, Second State Brewing in Cedar Falls, we will be on stop at the new Cedar Valley Beer Trail that gets rolling on May 22nd. By journalist Melody Parker. Cedar Falls. Beer, bikes, and hikes. It's what's brewing May 22nd when the Cedar Valley Beer Trail officially opens Saturday. The launch will take place from 10:30 to 12:30 at the River Place Plaza in the Cedar Falls downtown district, East 2nd and State Streets. There will be entertainment, yard games, and beer trail passports will be available. We have a great offering of breweries and tap rooms, and we're strong on the trail front. Fought through COVID-19, and we think everyone is ready to get out and participate in some great outdoor activities, said Kim Manning, Tourism and Cultural Manager at the Cedar Falls Tourism and Visitors Bureau. Locally owned breweries and restaurants, shopping, hotel accommodations, and activities are within easy proximity for the trails in the Cedar Falls downtown district. Southern Cedar Falls in the areas of College Square Mall and the University of Northern Iowa. Breweries and tap rooms include Second State Brewing, 203 South Street, Lark Brewing, 6301 University Avenue, College Square Mall, Single Speed, Cedar Falls, The Tap Room, 128 Main Street, Mulligan's Brick Oven, Grill and Pub, 205 East 18th Street, The Brass Tap, 421 Main Street, and The Octopus, 2205 College Street, all in Cedar Falls. Also on the trail is Single Speed Brewing Company and Restaurant at 325 Commercial Street, Waterloo, located in the reclaimed Wonder Bread Factory, and Veer Kombucha, 327 West 3rd Street. It sounds like a good deal. I think it helps not just our business, but businesses in general in the area. When there is something laid out that brings people into the area, it gives people a reason to get out and do something, said Nick Newgard of Second State Brewing. The Beer Trail Passport provides a map and routes for exploring beverage opportunities, including bike and car routes. Participants must be 21 and older. Passports can be offered for stamps at each brewery or tap room on the trail. After completing 4 stops in 1 week, 4 weeks or 2 months, the stamped passport can be redeemed for beer trail swag at the Cedar Falls Recreation Center or at the Cedar Falls Visitor Center. Our last article on the front page of Tuesday's Courier, headline reads, Cedar Falls Council drops mask mandate. Unanimous vote ends edict after 8 months, by journalist Amy Rivers. Cedar Falls. In light of new guidance from the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, relaxing mask guidelines for fully vaccinated people, the City of Cedar Falls unanimously threw out its citywide mandate in place for more than 8 months. It expires Thursday. The City Council enacted the mandate September 8th. It had required a mask on those older than 5 years old in both public buildings and private businesses, as well as on public transportation and ride-sharing services. Certain categories of people, like law enforcement, were exempted. The mask mandate has been extended several times since then, generally on a 4-3 vote, with council members Susan DeBoer, Darryl Cruz, and Dave Sires voting against it. Monday night, after Friday's CDC announcement, with more than 40% of Iowans fully vaccinated against COVID-19, they were joined by everyone else. "I will agree that I think the time has come," said at-large council member nurse Kelly Dunn. Several speakers agreed. As we heard from the top officials in the CDC, they have recommended that, said Rick Sharp, "we should follow their recommendations. We've been held to those masks for long enough," said Tammy Stahl, noting on a recent visit to Florida, "it was so wonderful to see people's faces and see them smile without face masks." TJ Friend pointed out that Iowa has turned away 71% of its allocated COVID-19 vaccines from the federal government, which happened at the beginning of the month, and said it was evidence people who want to be vaccinated have been. "It's, in my opinion, mission accomplished," he said. "There should be no reason why the mandate stays in place." Mayor Rob Green said he supported an end to the mandate and said staff had been predicting this outcome after the vote. He said the city will issue a press release noting that the change will mean this week. In other business, the council unanimously approved replacing a slab bridge of Olive Street with a twin box culvert that will extend from the existing College Street culvert to the east side of Olive Street. Construction will require temporary and permanent easement from 4 nearby property owners, and one property will be condemned as part of the project, according to documents presented by city staff. The College Hill Partnership, as well as the Friends of Peterson Plaza, supported the project. "It would add a great deal to the plaza," with Dan Breitbach with the Friends Group. "We think it would provide a safe access for residents living on Olive Street." Unanimously approved the first reading of an ordinance rezoning about 15 acres near Huntington Road and Cedar Falls Heights Drive to mixed-use residential to allow Oster Family Limited Partnership the ability to expand Principal Prairie. Ward 4 Councilman Simon Harding asked if next spring's FEMA flood maps, likely widened into that area, would hinder that project. "There are lots of lots in the city platted in the floodplain," said Karen Howard, planning and community service manager, adding developers still have to follow all floodplain regulations when building. Only 40% of Iowans are fully vaccinated against COVID-19. That means 4 out of 10. So, all right, in Cedar Valley news, city renames convention center. Plaza surrounding facility will be named for Sullivan Brothers, by journalist Sidney Krizen. Waterloo. The 5 Sullivan Brothers Convention Center is now the Waterloo Convention Center. The name change was unanimously approved Monday by the City Council. It includes naming the plaza surrounding the center Sullivan Brothers Plaza. Convention Center Management Company Spectra said it would market the facility with the full name Waterloo Convention Center at the Sullivan Brothers Plaza on marketing materials, logos, and social media sites. Spectra said the new name provides easier recognition of the location. Mayor Quinton Hart said he spoke with the Sullivan family about the change. The 5 Sullivan brothers from Waterloo died November 1942 when the ship USS Juan sunk off Guadalcanal during the World War II. Waterloo resident Dave Dreyer suggests the name change should go on the November ballot. He said lifelong Waterloo residents should decide the matter rather than city council members. "I have had conversations with the Sullivans," Hart said. "This project is going to highlight the unity, diversity, and togetherness of Waterloo. This is going to be one of the best projects we've ever had to talk about service, dedication, to honor veterans in this community. That's what this project is about." When Dreyer tried talking past his allotted time, Hart told him he was done. Dreyer responded, "I might be done, but you are done too." "Is that a threat? Are you threatening my life? What do you mean I'm done?" Hart asked, to which Dreyer replied, speaking, "Mr. Dreyer, I'm going to tell you like this. Because we disagree on issues, that gives you no right to talk to me like that, period." The city received 2 bids Monday for second floor renovations at the convention center. The lower base bid was nearly $1.6 million from Cardinal Construction of Waterloo, with the other at $1.7 million from Don Gardner Construction of Waterloo. The article is accompanied by a picture of the convention center with the caption, "Construction crews work on the former Five Sullivan Brothers Convention Center in downtown Waterloo on June 3, 2020. Other news in the Cedar Valley, Griffin replacement sparks pro-police PAC. Retired cops will back pro-police candidates in municipal elections, by journalist Sydney Kreisen. Pro-police candidates for Waterloo mayor and city council could get funding and campaign support from a new political action committee, according to a news release. The new PAC, called Cedar Valley Backs the Blue, is made up of retired Waterloo police officers. It was formed after the current city administration showed support for replacing the Waterloo police logo. According to the release, the logo, a red griffin, adopted in 1964, was criticized by some for resembling the Ku Klux Klan dragon. The group says city officials are deeply out of touch with the majority of their constituents in supporting logo replacement. Retired Officer Lynn Moeller, chair of the new PAC, said officials are caving to pressure from a small group of individuals despite overwhelming opposition from citizens. He said there is expert analysis showing the griffin has no link to historic racial symbols. The rebranding committee for the new police logo was created unanimously by the City Council in August. Its 12 voting and 4 non-voting members started meeting in October. The group narrowed more than 100 public design submissions before deciding on its final recommendation in April. The expensive and unnecessary attack by the mayor and city council has left many people scratching their heads, Moeller said in the news release. To us, the only thing that needs rebranding is our local government. Up for possible re-election in November are Mayor Quinton Hart and Councilmember Pat Morrissey, Margaret Klein, and Ray Fussey. Councilwoman Sharon Wan recently announced she will not be seeking another term, leaving her at-large seat open to new candidates. Running for office takes money and support, Moeller said in new release. We hope that our group forming will encourage like-minded people to put their names forward for local office. The public will soon be able to donate to the PAC through a bank account at Viridian Credit Union. A separate group that includes retired officers, the Waterloo Police Protective Association, recently offered its own logo design recommendation. That design was approved Monday night by the City Council. The next headline in the Cedar Valley News, shooting was Waterloo family's latest tragedy. Grandmother of man fatally shot Saturday also died violently, by Jeff Renounci, Waterloo. When Dayton Matlock Buss was shot and killed in a Waterloo neighborhood over the weekend, it was the second time in less than a decade that his family lost a member to gun violence. Waterloo police continue to investigate the early Saturday shooting at Grand Avenue and took Matlock Buss's life and sent two others to the hospital. Officers said neighbors called about gunfire in the area around 3:30 a.m., They found Matlock Buss, age 23, dead in an alley next to 1408 Grant. No arrests have been made, and investigators are still trying to piece together the details of what happened. Friends and relatives paid honor to Matlock Buss with a vigil Saturday night just outside the crime scene tape, said his aunt, Latina Walker. He had his flaws, but he was perfect for us, Walker said. The slaying is the second tragedy in recent years for the family. In 2012, Matlock Buss's grandmother, Kay Straw, 59, was shot and killed following a domestic dispute. Straw's daughter, Marlene Buss, had broken up with boyfriend Kevin Ambrose and filed a restraining order against him in the May of 2012. Ambrose armed himself with a pistol, returned to the Newell Street home where they had been living. He killed Straw and shot Buss in the back as she ran, wounding her. Ambrose also attempted to shoot another man at the home, but the handgun malfunctioned. A jury found Ambrose guilty of murder and attempted murder, and he was sentenced to life in prison. The article is accompanied by a picture of the Waterloo police cars, and the caption reads, "One man died and two women were injured in a shooting early Saturday." Next, article in the Cedar Valley News, "Victim in murder-suicide had no contact order," by Jeff Renouncey. A Waterloo man who killed the mother of his children before turning the gun on himself Saturday had been prohibited from contacting the victim, according to court records. Police said Tony Lomero Flowers, 50, shot and killed 43-year-old Tanya Charquette Spatz in her Pine View Place apartment, despite a restraining order stemming from a March incident where he attacked her and another person. In the March encounter, Flowers allegedly slapped Spatz and attempted to strangle her at the apartment, court records state. Police investigating the assault found a red mark on her neck. Flowers was also accused of punching a 10-year-old girl in the shoulder, records show. He was arrested for domestic assault causing bodily injury and assault and taken to jail. Flowers posted the $2,000 bond and was served with no contact order, which barred him from communicating with Spatz, being near her home, and possessing firearms. A trial was scheduled for June 29th on Saturday night around 11 p.m. Flowers left his home, traveled to the Pine View Place apartments off of West 4th Street, where Spatz continued to reside, police said. He shot and killed her in the apartment and drove off. After the shooting, investigators received information that Flowers was in the 4,400 block of East 4th Street, where the road leaves the city and enters the surrounding farm fields. Police noticed his vehicle when they arrived, and while they were cordoning off the area for safety, they heard a muffled gunshot. Officers approached the vehicle and found Flowers in the driver's seat with a single self-inflicted gunshot wound to his head and the gun still in his hand, according to police. Police said it wasn't immediately known how Flowers acquired the firearm. The last article in the Cedar Valley News, tickets now on sale for Courier's 8 over 80 event, Cedar Falls. Tickets are on sale for the Courier's annual 8 over 80 awards event. For the 11th year, the Courier will recognize community members over 80 who demonstrate leadership, contribute now and in the past to the betterment of the community, often behind the scenes, and who continue to be a success in their vocation or have been a role model and mentor to others. This year's winners are Ann Phillips, Ron and Mary Esther Pullen, Tom DeLong, Lianne Nichols, Luann Lorenzen, Donald Frazier, Stan and Bev McCandom, and Kay Conley. The recognition ceremony and luncheon will take place June 23rd at the Diamond Event Center, 5307 Caraway Lane. Tickets are $20 and are available online at wcfcourier.com/forms/8_over_80/, or see our ad on page A2 in today's Courier. For more information, you can call Lisa Bolin at 319-291-1478. Sponsors of this year's event are the Western Home Community, Cedar Valley Hospice, and the Community Foundation of Northeast Iowa. All right, listeners, you are listening to the reading of the Courier for Tuesday, May 18th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Rachel L. Heller, born March 31, 1933 to December 24, 2020. Grundy Center. Rachel L. Heller, 87, of Grundy Center, Iowa, passed away on Thursday, December 24, 2020, at Grundy Memorial Hospital due to COVID-19 complications. Following Rachel's wishes, cremation rites have been accorded, and there will be no public service held at this time. Due to the COVID-19 pandemic, The family is planning a small private memorial service for Rachel at a later date. In lieu of flowers, memorial contributions may be directed in Rachel's name to local Humane Society or Retrieving Freedom located at 1152 230th Street, Waverly, Iowa, 50677. For further information or to leave a condolence, please visit www.ablesfuneralhome.com. Rachel L. Heller was born on March 31, 1933, in Iowa, the daughter of Jesse H. and Clara Lorraine Young Heller. She was raised and educated in the Grundy School District, where she graduated from high school. Rachel was a hard-working woman. She began her career working at the Rich Lou Factory in Grundy Center until she moved to Rockford, Illinois, where she was a welder in a radio factory. Following her retirement, Rachel decided to move back to Grundy Center. Rachel is survived by several nieces and nephews and two sister-in-laws, Marilyn Heller and Bob Heller. She is preceded in death by her parents, Jesse and Clara Heller, brothers and sister-in-law, Orvin Mary Heller, Carl and spouse Doris Heller, Duane and spouse Jeanette Heller, Irvin and spouse Marion Heller, Richard and Arlene Heller, Marvin Heller, sister and brother-in-law Greta Bob Lynch, one niece Nancy, and one nephew Greg, and many of her four-legged furry family members. Dennis Fred Yumptum, July 22, 1943 to May 15, 2021, Waverly. Dennis Fred Yumptum, age 77, of Waverly, died Saturday, May 15, 2021. Dennis was born on July 22, 1943 in Owine, Iowa, the son of Fred and Norma Plaster Yumptum. He was raised in Sumner, Iowa, and graduated from the Sumner High School in 1963. He then entered the United States Air Force in 1963 and was honorably discharged in 1967. On August 10, 1965, Dennis was united in marriage to Barb Youngblood at St. John's Lutheran Church in Sumner. The couple made their home in Waverly, where Dennis worked for the City of Waverly and then John Deere in the purchasing department before retiring in 2001. Dennis was a member of St. Paul's Lutheran Church in Waverly. He enjoyed fishing, bird watching, spending winters in Texas, working in the yard, and spending time with family and friends. He was a member of the Thomas E. Woods American Legion Post 223 in Sumner for 54 years. Dennis's memory is honored by his wife, Barb Yumptum of Waverly, two sons, Derek and Kim Yumptum of Elkhorn, Nebraska, and Jason and spouse Lynn Yumptum of Greta, Nebraska, six grandchildren, Duncan, Evan, Maya, Isabella, Graham, and Finley Yumptum. His mother, Norma, and a sister, Sharon Hirsch of Waverly. He was preceded in death by his father. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. on Thursday, May 20th at St. Paul Lutheran Church and Schools in Waverly, with Pastor Arthur Bergen officiating. St. Paul's Lutheran Church will be live streaming the service. Burial will follow at St. John's Lutheran Cemetery in Sumner. Memorials may be directed to Dennis's family for later designation, and online condolences may be left at www.kaisercorson.com, or you may call at 319-352-1187. Donald William Bone, December 18, 1928 to May 15, 2021. Donald William Bowen, 92, passed away on Saturday, May 15, 2021, while a resident at Parkview Manor with family members by his side. Services will be held Thursday, May 20th at 11 a.m. at the First Presbyterian Church in Rhinebeck. Burial will follow at the Rhinebeck Cemetery in Rhinebeck, with military honors conducted by the Rhinebeck American Legion Post 242. Visitation will be held on Wednesday, May 19th from 5 p.m. until 7 p.m. at Abel's Funeral and Cremation Service, French Hand Chapel in Rhinebeck, and 1 hour before the service on Thursday. Memorials may be directed to the family. Online condolences may be made by visiting www.ablesfuneralhome.com. Don was born in Waterloo, Iowa, on December 18, 1928, to Roger and Ida Mae Ingalls Brown. The second of seven children, he resided in LaPorte City, Iowa, attending school there until the fifth grade, when the family then moved to Rhinebeck. He attended Rhinebeck Community Schools up until his senior year. In 1952, he enlisted with the United States Army and served in the Korean War. Following his discharge in 1953, he returned to Rhinebeck and began a 38-year career with Pioneer Hybrid International, retiring in 1990. On June 10, 1956, he married Carol Holstrom in Hazleton, Iowa. To this union, one son, Laverne, was born. Don was a member of the First Presbyterian Church Rhinebeck, American Legion Post 242, a 36-year member of the Rhinebeck Volunteer Fire Department, and an active member of the local chapter of the Isaac Walton League. Don enjoyed hunting with friends, traveling to Branson, Missouri, and spending time with his three granddaughters. He is survived by his bride of 64 years, Carol, Rhinebeck, Iowa, his son Laverne and spouse Betsy of Sydney, Nebraska, brothers Robert and spouse Pat, Jerry and spouse Charlotte of Rhinebeck, Iowa, Warren and spouse Violet of Cedar Falls, at Richard, St. Clair Shores, Michigan, sister-in-laws Norman Jean Kofelt, Denver, Colorado, and Brenda Hempton, Cedar Falls, Iowa, granddaughters Lacey and Stephen Miller, Omaha, Nebraska, Amanda and spouse Andrew Leader, Alliance, Nebraska, and Aaron Brown, Kearney, Nebraska, great-grandsons Caden and Landon Miller, Omaha, Nebraska. He was preceded in death by his grandparents, parents Roger and Ida Mae, brother Eugene, and his wives Helen and Doris, sister Marianne Hempton, brother-in-law Harlan Hempton, niece Lynette Besh, and great-nephew Nicholas Bowen. Next obituary for Tuesday, May 18th, is Vincent F. Williams, September 16, 1950 to May 12, 2021. Waterloo. Vincent F. Vince Williams, 70, of Waterloo, died Wednesday, May 12 at Unity Point Health Allen Hospital. He was born September 16, 1950 in Waterloo, the son of Warren and Dorothy Poppenhagen Williams. He married Cindy Lou Oster, October 12, 2001, in California. She died December 14, 2017. Vince graduated from Waterloo East High School and worked at Viking Pump, Cedar Falls for 30 years as a machinist. Vince was a kind-hearted man who never met a stranger. He loved sharing stories with his interests in classic cars like his Cadillac, Camaro, and Corvette, and stories of his many travels with his wife, Cindy Lou. He is survived by his sister, Lois Williams of Waterloo, his cousin Galen and Diane Poppenhagen of Cedar Falls, two cousins Donna and spouse Fred Zomlek of Dyke, Bonnie Poppenhagen of Cedar Falls, preceded in death by his parents and his wife. Services will be held at 10:30 Friday, December 21st at Hagerty Wyckoff Garup Funeral Service on West Ridgeway with burial in the Garden of Memories Cemetery. Public visitation will be 1 hour before the services at the funeral home. Memorials may be directed to the family. Online condolences may be left at www.hagertywyckoffgarup.com. Our last obituary for today is Deacon Donald E. Don Ferdigs, September 18, 1937 to May 14, 2021. a mass of Christian burial for Deacon Donald E. Dunn, Fredericks 83 of Eldridge, formerly of Blue Grass, will be 11 a.m. Wednesday, May 19th at St. Andrew Catholic Church, Blue Grass. His family will greet friends from 9 to 11 a.m. Burial will be in the Cedar Memorial Cemetery, Cedar Rapids. Deacon Don died on Friday, May 14, 2021. In lieu of flower, donations may be made to St. Andrew Church. Halligan McCobb DeVries Funeral Home assisted with the arrangements. Donald Edward Fredericks, born September 18, 1937, in LaPorte City, Iowa, the son of Harry B. and Mary T. Fredericks. He married Sandra A. Sandy Brown on November 26, 1960, at St. Patrick Catholic Church, Cedar Rapids. Those left to honor his memory include his loving wife, Sandy, their children, Troy and spouse Melanie Fredericks, Des Moines, Timothy and spouse Kelly Fredericks, Princeton, Lynette and spouse Brad Creighton, Bettendorf, Melinda and Donald Furman, Forest City, and Tiffany and spouse Troy Parman, DeWitt, Iowa. There are 11 grandchildren, 11 great-grandchildren, brother Marvin and spouse Dorothy Fredericks, sister-in-law Mary Jo Fredericks, Carol C.J. Fredericks, and numerous extended family. He was preceded in death by his parents, brothers Ivan and Barbara, Melvin, Glenn, sister Mary, Teachout, and Carol Becker, and a baby sister, sister-in-law Jolynn Meskin, and a son-in-law, Jeffany Tyson. Online remembrances may be left at www.hmdfuneralhome.com. All right, some other news. We have for the Cedar Valley, one dead in golf cart crash at Dyke Course. Dyke, by journalist Jeff Renouncey. A Marshalltown man was killed in an accident on a golf course Friday. John Eppenschild, 56, was crossing County Line Club Line in a Yamaha golf cart to enter the Fox Ridge course around 12:49 p.m. when the cart and a Dodge Durango that was headed south on County Club collided, according to the Grundy County Sheriff's Office. Eppenschild was transported to Cedar Falls Hospital, then transferred to the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics in Iowa City, where he later died, according to the Sheriff's Office. The driver of the Durango, 66-year-old Cynthia Beavers of Dyke, wasn't injured. The accident remains under investigation by the Grundy County Sheriff's Office and the Iowa State Patrol. Dunkerton teen killed, three teens injured in crash, by journalist Jeff Renouncey. Dunkerton. Authorities have identified the person who died in a rollover crash Sunday night as a Dunkerton teen. Mackenzie Farmer, 15, died at the scene of the accident on Mount Vernon Road near Nesbitt Road, according to the Blackhawk County Sheriff's Office. Farmer was one of two passengers who were ejected from the vehicle. The other, Lindsay Hoffman, 17, of Dunkerton, was transported to Unity Point Allen Hospital in Waterloo and then flown to the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics in Iowa City. Another passenger, Ashley Latham, 15, of Dunkerton, along with the driver, 15-year-old Riley Boyer, were transported to Allen Hospital for injuries and released, according to the sheriff. The accident remains under investigation. Condolences to everyone there. TV news reporter faces domestic assault charge, by Courier staff, Waterloo. A Waterloo television news anchor has been arrested on domestic violence charges. Waterloo police arrested Danielle Minsko, 34, for domestic assault with injury, a misdemeanor on Thursday. She was released to pretrial services pending trial. A no-contact order was filed in the case. Minskal is a weekend anchor and reporter at KWWL-TV. She started in March, according to the station's website. Authorities allege she assaulted William Moore, her boyfriend, at their Jefferson Street apartment. According to court records, officers were sent to the building shortly before 10 p.m. on Thursday and after another tenant reported arguing. Moore exited the apartment, holding an ice pack on his face and swelling on his left eye. Police allege Minsk hit and kicked him multiple times. And the last, Waterloo Man allegedly stomped on man's head, by Jeff Renouncey. Waterloo Man has been arrested for allegedly stomping on another man's head during a fight over the weekend. Waterloo police arrested Dylan Ray Guffison, 21, of 433 Kingsley Avenue on Saturday for one count of willful injury causing serious injury. Bond was set at $25,000. According to court records, Austin Beverly was involved in an argument with Guffison's cousin at 307 Adam Street around 5 a.m. Saturday. During the argument, Guffison picked up Beverly, threw him to the ground, and stomped on his face, records state. Beverly suffered a broken nose and a skull fracture, and he was taken to a local hospital for treatment. Officers found blood on Guffison's sweatshirt and shoes, as well as a video of the assault, according to court records. All right, listeners, that leaves a little bit of time for some sports news today. Faraday earns another medal. Columbus standout wins initial postseason meet by 11 strokes, by staff report. Claremont, Waterloo Columbus junior Molly Faraday advanced in the golf postseason after earning the medalist honor with an 11-stroke margin of victory during Monday's opening round of regional play at Pleasant Valley Sports Club. Faraday finished with a score of 83 on the challenging golf course. Wakan's Margaret Walker placed second with a 94. Wakan captured the team title with 386 total. Jessup and Waterloo Columbus tied for second at 413. Jessup advances as the final qualifying team into the second regional round due to a lower fifth individual score. Alex Harris led the Jayhawks with a 99. Valley Divisional. Waterloo West jumped ahead of Cedar Rapids Kennedy and moved into third place after the final round in the Valley Divisional on Monday at Irv Warren Golf Course. The Wahawks finished with a 45-hole, three-round total of 976. Dubuque Hempstead won the meet with 914, and Iowa City West was second with 933. West was paced Monday by Maddie Dolan's score of 86 and finished fifth individually with a 45-hole total of 219. Her Wahawk teammate, Chase Dolan, added a 93 for a seventh-place finish at 228. Dubuque Hempstead's Morgan Hawkins held on to her lead and won with a total score of 195. Cedar Rapids' Xavier Caitlin Hotchkiss recorded the Monday low of 80 and finished with a team score of 212. Other sports news, college softball. Cyclones Williams, the total package, by journalist Ben Besser. Ames, Iowa State softball coach Jamie Pinkerton has never been around a player like Sammy Williams in his 23 years of coaching. He coached in the ACC, the SEC, and the Big 12, among other conferences. I've never had a player that's the total package and is the epitome of a student-athlete, Pinkerton said. I know this probably puts undue pressure on Sammy, but she's a generational talent. I've had three or four players similar to her. One was an All-American and a great player, but not a good teammate. I had another that was an All-American, a great player, and a good teammate, but not a good student. And then you get Sammy. Williams is a three-time Academic All-American, 2018 to 2020. She has her degree in software engineering, and she just earned her master's degree in data analytics. On the field, she has set pretty much every Iowa State batting record in the book. Williams appears four times on the season's hit list, including the number one spot when she recorded 82 hits in 2019, and number two spot when she recorded 79 hits this season. And this season isn't over yet, as Iowa State made its first NCAA tournament appearance since 1988, thanks in large part to Williams. Williams is batting a .457 this year, 30 points higher than the second best in Iowa State history. Williams has 21 home runs this season, which is the most in Iowa State history, beating her old record of 17 home runs in 2019. The senior has 67 career home runs. Second place is Tori Torquezano, who hit 42. In the field, she's been Iowa State's anchor at shortstop. She has 571 career assists, the most all-time at Iowa State. Missy Miller, in the early 90s, is now in second with 454 assists. Last weekend in the Big 12, Williams became the Big 12's all-time hit leader. For the first 3.5 years, I tell anyone who would listen, Sammy is the best player you've never heard of, Pinkerton said. A lot of people know her now. While Williams' numbers have jumped off the page since she was a freshman, she hit 3.363 her debut season. She hasn't always had the confidence to go with her production. That was something she developed throughout her time as a Cyclone. Something that separates me now from being part of my career is the mental game, Williams said. Early in my career, I'd get so nervous on the field and I'd let those nerves get to me. I'd feel so disappointed and feel like I let down my teammates if I didn't succeed. Through the years, I was able to talk through that with my teammates and coaches. What I learned works for me with the nerves is just interpreting them as excitement. It's the same feeling you get when you're excited for something. That was important for Williams to do because the softball is a game where if you fail 7 out of 10 times, you're still successful. When I first started doing that, I'd get nervous and then I'd just start laughing on the field because I was like, wow, I can just turn these nerves a different way and turn them into something positive. I just feel comfortable out there. Now I just don't even have to really think about it. You have to learn how to handle the failures and not think of them as failures so you can get the most out of them, move on, and keep growing. Off the field, Williams is just as impressive. She already has a job lined up with Boeing, working on their data management team. Pinkerton's favorite part about Williams, she's an excellent teammate on and off the field. She's a servant leader, and I know that's a coaching cliche, but she is. Pinkerton said, on road trips, when we have a caterer in food, she makes sure everyone else eats before she does, and then she'll be one of the volunteer to clean up. Just the other day, she was walking into the practice facility, and I was walking in with a couple of freshmen, and we were probably 10 paces back of her. There was some garbage laying on the sidewalk, and I whispered to the freshman, watch Sammy. She's going to pick that garbage up and put it in the trash. 2 steps later, she picks it up and puts it in the trash. That's the kind of person and player she is. She's very selfless. Williams, a Laguna, California native, came to Iowa State when the softball program wasn't much of anything. In her first 2 years, she endured 2 coaching changes. This program has changed because of her leadership and at times, quite frankly, because she put this team on her back, Pinkerton said. Said Williams, I came here thinking I could be a program changer and a culture changer, and that was kind of my goal. I feel like I've accomplished that goal with some potential extra fun on the way. To end on this note, finally reaching your ultimate goal has been really special. And we'll end today with the favorite part of my paper, and maybe it is yours too, listeners, called Call the Courier. All right, our first question. Did the Burger King on Jefferson Street close permanently, and when did it close? Answer, the restaurant is still open, serving until 10 p.m. in the dining room and 11 p.m. at the drive-thru. Question, is Chubby Checker still alive? Answer, born Ernest Evans on October 3, 1941, Chubby Checker, the rock and roll singer best known for his hit cover song The Twist, is still with us. Question, the other day I was driving on Fletcher and Blackhawk Road, and a helicopter was going very low, treetop level, over by Hope Martin Park. I was wondering what that could be. Answer, perhaps it was a training exercise for soldiers at the Iowa Army National Guard's Aviation Support Facility in Waterloo. There reportedly have been several exercises in recent days. Other possibilities include law enforcement or a medical transport helicopter. Question, what happened to Christopher King on KGAN? Answer, he's now working for the CBS affiliate in Atlanta, according to his social media. Question, please print Mr. Food's recipe for graham cracker cake. Answer, here it is. What you'll need, 2 sticks, 1 cup butter, softened, divided, 1.5 cups granulated sugar, 1 13.5-ounce package of graham cracker crumbs, 2 teaspoons of baking powder, 3/4 cup milk, 5 eggs, 1 teaspoon vanilla extract, 1/2 cup flaked coconuts, 1/2 cup chopped pecans, 3 cups confectioner's sugar, 1 8-ounce can crushed pineapple, undrained. What to do? Preheat your oven to 350 degrees. Coat a 9x13-inch baking dish with cooking spray. Set aside. In a large bowl with the electric mixer on medium speed, beat 1.5 sticks of butter and the granulated sugar 3 to 4 minutes until creamy. Add graham cracker crumbs, baking powder, eggs, milk, and vanilla. Beat until well mixed. Stir in coconut and pecans until well mixed. Then spread batter into baking dish. Melt remaining 1/2 stick of butter in the microwave. In a large bowl, combine the melted butter, sugar, pineapple until well mixed. Pour evenly over batter. Bake 45 to 50 minutes or until a wooden toothpick inserted in its center comes out clean. Cool and then cut and serve. When was the last time cicadas were in Iowa? Answer, the only cicadas bugging eastern Iowa this year will be annual cicadas, the green or black cicadas that make noise during summer dog days from July to the first frost. The last big brood of periodical cicadas in Iowa, brood 3, emerged in 2014 in a region that extends from Ledges State Park near Boone down the Des Moines River Valley all the way to Missouri. Northeast Iowa had a periodical cicada emergence in 2007, slated to reappear in 2024. But surveys in 2007 also showed that periodical cicadas are mostly gone from the state. Question: I heard President Biden say thousands of states and federal workers have been laid off due to the pandemic. Do you have the numbers for state and federal workers laid off by Iowa? Answer: according to Iowa Workforce Development, there were 251,500 employees at all levels of government in Iowa in April 2021, a drop of 12,400 from March 2020, when there was 263,900 government workers at the advent of the pandemic. And that does it today, listeners, for the reading of the Courier for Tuesday, May 18th, 2021, on this rainy Tuesday. I'm your reader, Mary Dove.